Welcome to another exciting episode here at IT Pro TV. I'm your host, Mike Roderick, and today we're going over CISSP, and we're working in Domain 1, Security and Risk Management. And specifically, we're going to take a look at compliance. And Adam, there's a lot of different types of compliance. We've got legislative and privacy requirements compliance, and hopefully you're here, you're going to help us wade our way through this.
Well, we'll do our best, obviously, right? And we'll try to figure that out. So when we think about compliance, what we're ultimately thinking about is this idea of being able to go in and decide what we have to focus on, right? You know, the general thought process in information security is that somebody somewhere has come up with a plan. It may not be us, right? But ultimately, somebody somewhere has given us some what we call guidance. And guidance is a really important term when it comes to compliance, because what guidance indicates is that somebody has laid out a set of steps, procedures, thought processes. We can refer to them different ways, but ultimately a path. And when we think about a path, we have to know where it starts. We have to know what it looks like, how far down the road we can get on that path, and what the end point is. And when we translate that into information security, what we're thinking about is how we measure, ultimately, metrics are very important to do this, how we measure, ultimately, whether or not we are successful at pursuing something. And compliance is specifically about aligning with whatever the requirements are to ensure success, typically driven by legal or regulatory concerns. So we may be compliant with a standard that says that all of our information must be stored in encrypted fashion when it's at rest, what we call data at rest. If data at rest has to be encrypted, then the compliance issue is about whether we are encrypting data, under what circumstances, at rest, so we have to validate that, using what kind of encryption, is the encryption we're using up to the standard or standards that have been stipulated. There may be more than one choice, we'd have to figure out what that is. And as a result of that, do we have what we call traceability, and do we have visibility as well as accountability assigned and ascribed to this process? Can we go in other words, and can we validate really at in a moment's time, at any point in time, that the data is indeed encrypted when it's at rest? Is it encrypted at the proper strength? Do we have the information surrounding that encryption documented so we know how it's being done? These are the kind of things that compliance may require us to do. Compliance is typically, as I said, legally going to be driven by or aligned with regulatory or legal concerns. So when we often hear people talk about compliance, when you, security professionals, have conversations about compliance, what we should be thinking about is whether or not there is a standard that we have to be aligned with, some sort of law that we may have to be aware of, and how we then will go through and think about what those things may be. So, for instance, in the United States, in North America, specifically within the U.S., we have certain legislative requirements for the protection and confidentiality of information. We have HIPAA, which is going to deal with information in the healthcare sector, right? So we're going to focus on patients' privacy and their electronic records or electronic medical records and the focus on that. If we're thinking about Graham Leach Bliley, we're thinking about the Bank Secrecy Act, we're thinking about financial information being safeguarded. If we think about FERPA, we're thinking about standards for the education space, federal education space, and the safeguarding of students and their records when they're attending school. There's all these things we have to be aligned with. Compliance could take a very different approach under any one of these regulatory regimes, although there's probably some very standard baseline elements. Information has to be identified, has to be categorized, and ultimately some sort of protection has to be applied to that information so that information is kept secure. And we define what secure and private may mean under the terms of that compliance regime. So when we think about dealing with data that comes from another place, for instance, we are a business, IT Pro TV, and we exist in the United States, but we sell content to customers overseas, in Europe, in Latin America, in Asia. We're worldwide, as Pitbull says, right? So if we are all over the world and we're selling content everywhere, well, you know, I'm from Miami, got to work in that whole Pitbull thing, right? So when we do all that, right, we have to worry about the information that is going to be stored in our CRM system, right, our customer relationship management system, for customers coming from Europe in particular, in this case, because European customers, European people that are in the European Union, are going to be subjecting their thought process around privacy and filtering their thought process around privacy of their information through the European Privacy Directive. EU 9546, or EC 9546 is the number and name of the directive. As a result of that, if as a business we are not aligning with the general protection requirements under a safe harbor provision of some kind, a provision that allows a North American, specifically a U.S.-based entity, a business, to maintain that data, to be able to safeguard it using general standards that align with the EC 9546 directive, although it may not be as specific as the 9546 directive protection requirements are, then we're not going to be able to maintain that data. The courts in Europe and the European Union will say, you know, that data is not being held properly. It's not being protected. You're not aligned. And as a result of that, there is an issue. And you may not be able to keep those records and do business with our nationals, because that's an issue for you, Mr. or Mrs. Corporate Entity, who's looking to do business in the European Union. And they may block us from doing so. And this has happened to other companies. Now, there's been a wave of kind of retrenchment around safe harbor over the last, let's say, 12 months approximately. We're at the end of, you know, a cycle now with the discussion about privacy, where the European courts have pushed us to rethink what alignment and ultimately being able to say you are following those requirements means. They're redefining them, in other words. And so the traditional thought process around safe harbor is actually changing and is being redefined. And as a result of that, it may mean something in the future. But the general idea behind safe harbor, regardless of what it may mean in the specificity of the European Union and their version, their vision of safe harbor with regards to the United States will change, and indeed is undergoing change right now. But ultimately, the generic concept of safe harbor is really a more broad topic. It's the idea of being able to align with the requirements, the legislative or regulatory requirements for compliance, in such a way that the people or the entity that is stipulated what those requirements are feel you are honoring the spirit of the law and the compliance, even though you may not follow the letter of the compliance or the law. And as a result of that, you are then allowed to exist, to do business, to interact under that regulatory regime. This is a very important concept generically, the idea of safe harbor. And it's one that you should definitely focus on as you look to prepare for and go through the material in this particular section overall in Domain 1, Security and Risk Management, within the CISSP body of knowledge. When we think about GRC activities, governance, risk, and compliance is what GRC stands for. You'll often hear us use, you'll hear me use, a lot of acronyms when we talk about information security. It's a language in and of itself and unto itself, and information security is, and we speak in shorthand a lot of the time. And a lot of you, probably just like myself and Mike and the rest of us that have been doing this a long time, are used to what a IP address is, and you know that. You know what TCP/IP is as a suite of protocols and tools. You may or may not know what GRC is, even though I just defined it for you. But what I want to make sure you're aware of with regards to preparing for the ISC 2 CISSP exam, the ISC squared CISSP exam, and for any of the exams that go under the ISC squared banner, SSCP, CCSP, whatever it may be, all the other certifications, as well as CISSP. We focus on acronyms, but we never use them on the exam without spelling them out. And so as a result, what I don't want you to do is spend a whole bunch of time memorizing the acronym name. What I want you to do is learn the content and learn the understanding, or have the understanding, make it your own, of the concept, and make sure you can apply the concept. But don't worry about IP equals Internet Protocol, TCP/IP equals Transmission Control / Internet Protocol. We'll spell those out, right? And that's going to be an important knowledge item for you, so you're optimizing your time as you go to study and ultimately learn what we're talking about. So with regards to GRC, we're focusing on a suite of activities, a system that we build inside the organization to help us identify, as we've talked about in some other discussions, and manage risk and really focus on risk from different perspectives. What are the governance? What are the risk management? What are the compliance perspectives associated with information security? This is what GRC activities have to deal with, right? And so when we think about not just GRC, generically, let's give you a practical example of GRC-related frameworks. You may or may not have heard of something called COBIT. COBIT is an IT governance framework. Comes from an entity called ISACA, I-S-A-C-A, ISACA.org. They have other certifications and markets. You may or may not have heard of them. You can obviously go check them out at some point. But ISACA, among the many things that they do, they've come up with the COBIT framework. It's currently in version 5, I believe. And as a result of that, the idea of the COBIT framework allows us to frame the concepts and the conversation within the business around IT governance and what governance, risk, and compliance activities mean. It's a practical, real-world, distilled example of how you put your hands on GRC activities and frame them within the business. And we use conversations like this with a framework like COBIT to go in and have conversations with the stakeholders in the business to help them understand and identify what we need to be aware of as security professionals and ultimately what the business needs to do to be aligned with risk, risk management, governance, which is the application of the management of risk activities to the business, how we do that day to day, and compliance, which is the sanity check to make sure we're aligning with the regulatory and legal requirements that whoever is in charge has said these are the things we have to show that we can do. These are the activities, and this is how we define them. It's very important when you think about those things, right? Knowing what they are, how they come about, what we can do with them, how we define them, becomes very important for us ultimately to think through and ultimately understand. When we think about, as I mentioned, the European Union, specifically the Data Protection or Data Protection Directive, the EU discussion about privacy has really been engaged in a very, very long discussion over many years, and the thought process around the development of privacy in the European Union is really more advanced. It's really gone further down the road than in many other countries in the world or entities or geographic associations in the world today. They really stand at the forefront in many ways of the drive to secure and create privacy protections for the individual. There is something called the right to be forgotten within the European Union today that allows individuals to request that their data be removed from online databases. So things like Google, like YouTube or Facebook or, you know, places like that. If you are a member of the European Union as a citizen, you have the right to claim a right to be forgotten under law. And you actually can request that your information be removed from those online systems. There was recently a very big move to do that. And one of the big first cases that tested that whole right came up in Europe and was actually successfully pushed through. And Facebook had to remove a bunch of data, as did Twitter, from online systems with regards to people that requested that they be removed. So this is a really important thing. In the United States, while we do certainly have very detailed legislation around privacy in some areas, like I mentioned, with HIPAA, with bank secrecy laws and things of that nature, in the education space, federal education space, we don't have as much overarching thought process around the privacy of the individual as some of the other areas of the world do today. And that's not to say that that's a good or a bad thing. That's just to say that that's just the reality of where we find ourselves today. And we have to acknowledge that and be aware of that. But most countries do have privacy laws. Most countries will have some form of privacy regulation on their books that, as security professionals, we would have to have knowledge of and be aware of. So, for instance, Mike, you ever been to Australia?
I have not.
Mike's never been to Australia. Have you ever been to Australia, right? I've never been myself, but as a security professional, and Mike as well, if Mike and I were going to be dealing with a customer in Australia, because Mike secretly does want to go and dive the Barrier Reef, he just won't admit that in public. But if Mike and I go to Australia and do some work down there for a customer, Mike's going to have to do a little reading on what the Australian Privacy Act is. And Australia has a legislative act called the Privacy Act that focuses on privacy and rights of the individual and business responsibility with regards to that. As a professional acting in that space, it's my responsibility to know what the requirements are so that my customer is compliant and they don't face risk associated with being not compliant when they manage data. Now, my customer may be a business outside of Australia, but doing business with Australian citizens or seeking to open an office in Australia or some combination of that. Or I may be dealing with an Australian business that is going to buy and sell my goods and services and rebrand them. But because of the Privacy Act there, I have to understand the legal implications of allowing them to manage data because they're going to do it a different way than what the legal requirements may be here in the United States. And so I have to really be thinking through the implications of what it means to be secure today and what that could mean for me, but also for my business and for my business broadly in the global space today. You know, we don't just exist in one area anymore. I mean, in theory, we do, right? We may not be a global company, but that doesn't mean that we don't have exposure beyond the geographic boundary where we live. Where is our data? Our data may be moving through systems around the world as it's accessed by customers. That data can be subject to regulatory compliance and governance and risk management concerns by law in the countries where it transits if the data is stopped, interdicted, and examined by a legal process that says, hey, wait a second, you've got data moving through our pipes. That data is subjected to the legal requirements of our jurisdiction. We're putting a hold on that data. We've got a piece of paper here, right, that says we are entitled to see that data. That internet service provider, that cloud provider, right, may actually have to show that data to a legal representative of a government or a government agency because the data is moving through France or Germany or the UK or Poland or Romania or who knows where. Right? It could be anywhere in the world. But the point is, your data doesn't just go from your computer out to this mythical thing we call the cloud and back again without crossing national geographies and national boundaries. Cabling that runs that data around the world runs through geographies, runs underneath them, right? And as a result of that, we have a problem. We have a concern. And this is a really big one today for security professionals. Gone are the days where your data is yours. Your data belongs to you, but it also may potentially be seen by other people. And this is something you have to be aware of and really think about as a security professional, as a CISSP. How are you going to safeguard that data? What are you going to do? What are the laws and the regulatory requirements that you need to be aware of? In Argentina is another example, right? Personal data protection law. Again, if I do business, not just in Latin America, not just in Central America, not just in South America, but specifically in that one country, I have to understand that legal requirement or those legal requirements based on the personal data protection law that's on the books in Argentina. It may be very different, and indeed it is, from other laws in other countries. Doesn't matter. I have to be subject to that if my data is there. And so it's really today about understanding those concerns. Canada has a law called PIPEDA, P-I-P-E-D-A, Personal Information Protection and Electronic Documents Act. There's numerous examples of these. I could pull out 45 different ones and rattle them off for you here in the next 5 minutes. That's not important. You don't need to know all of them specifically for the CISSP exam. What you need to know more broadly is the idea that as a security professional today, you are responsible. Remember, we've talked about due care and due diligence. Great way to bring that back into our conversation. You are responsible for understanding what the requirements are to ensure governance, risk management, and compliance is being applied to your entity, to the company, and through your company, aligning those requirements the stakeholders have. It's your due diligence and due care responsibility, ultimately, that we rest on. And if the security professional gets it wrong, they're on the hook. They could be legally liable. You could be legally liable. We can blame Mike and say it's Mike's fault. And, you know, Mike could be responsible ultimately because Mike's just that kind of a guy. But the reality is Mike's not the one that's going to go to jail. It's going to be you. Your name is on that recommendation. Your name is on that agreement. Your name is on that org chart where it says security professional who should know better. And they insert your name and picture, right? If that's you, then you bear responsibility ultimately. And depending on the law, you may bear legal responsibility, and you may actually get dragged into court and potentially could go to jail if things go horribly wrong. And I'm not suggesting they will, and I'm not suggesting you would be on the hook. I'm simply pointing out that under certain laws in certain places in the world today, you may be the name that we come back and talk to. And you also have to be aware of that as a security professional. It's very important. When we think about the thought process behind protecting information. We've talked a lot about confidentiality, integrity, and availability already, right? And we think about information, you know, information can exist in many forms. We often think about digital information today. We think about bits and bytes, right? We talk about data as a thing, an entity that exists, and it does, has a life of its own. It's managed as a specific thought process or with specific thought processes, and we've talked about them. But generically, the idea behind it is that we have a set of laws and a set of thought processes that we apply to data, specifically called intellectual property laws or IP law, not IP as in the protocol, but intellectual property IP. This is a whole area of law, and this is an area that's well established, been around for many, many years, in some cases going all the way back to the 1800s, depending on what we're talking about. And as a result of that, we have to really identify some terms. Intellectual property, very important. What is a patent? What is a copyright? What is a trademark? We need to understand those terms and what they are, because if we understand those concepts, we understand how to provide safeguards and protection for information in different categories. So hypothetically, right? Let's talk about IT Pro TV for just a moment. So IT Pro TV has this awesome logo. You can see it right here on my shirt. You see it on Mike's whenever we zoom in on one of us. And you know, you probably, whenever you log into the site in order to be able to watch one of our episodes, you're seeing it all over the place, right? So that logo, the IT Pro TV logo, belongs to the entity, right, that's behind IT Pro TV. It's their intellectual property. And as a result of that, they want to protect it because obviously it's part of the brand of IT Pro TV. Makes a lot of sense. It's recognizable anywhere. Makes for great logos on T-shirts, right? People come up to you on the street. Hey, that's cool. I want that, right? So it's important for them to have the protection that goes with the idea of being able to say this is ours and nobody else can use this unless they pay us for the right to do so. So you could go out and provide different property protection under the guise of a patent, a trademark, or a copyright. So let's talk about what those are. So when we think about a patent, Mike, right? Mm-hmm. We often think about the idea that a patent is an exclusive right or an exclusive grant for use, but specifically an exclusive right or use for the grant of an invention. So you have to go out and create something, right? You can't just say, hey, you know what? This thing I'm holding in my hand here, this pen, yeah, I want to get a patent on that. Well, you know, if you're not Pilot company, because it's a Pilot pen, if you're not Pilot, and you didn't create the concept of the ballpoint pen, then we're not giving you a patent on this novel writing instrument called a pen, because that is somebody else's invention. Somebody else holds a patent, in other words, and they have the right to it. You get to pay, in effect, to use that, and a patent gives the inventor an exclusive lock on the use of that technology for a period of time. They get to decide who gets to use it, under what terms, and as a result, they can charge for it. You often hear tell of this, and this has been in the news again recently as well, with regards to things like the biopharma sector, where drugs, for instance, development of medicine, things like that, tends to be talked about with regards to patents, because you get the rights to patent a drug when you invent it. If it's a novel and new concept is really what the definition of a patent from a perspective of being an invention needs to be. You may invent a pen, but if you invent a novel and new way of dealing with the idea of a pen, you can go out and patent that, even though Pilot may have the patent for their version of a pen, right? If our version has something new that's never been tried before, I can gain a patent for that new and novel invention. And so in the biopharma space, you often hear about drugs being patented because they are new and novel. Somebody comes up with a new drug that treats cancer, a new drug that treats the flu, or who knows, whatever it may be. And if that's new, we can get a patent for that. That patent is worth tremendous amounts of money, probably billions of dollars in that space. But the problem is for the drug manufacturers that it may have taken them billions of dollars to figure out how to make that drug. So they need that protection in order to effectively recoup their investment. So patents are very important. Trademarks, a word, a name, a symbol, or a device that's used can be trademarked, right? So, for instance, the IT Pro TV logo can be trademarked because it is a symbol, and we can trademark that in order to be able to say, hey, this is protected. It belongs to whoever owns the trademark. So think of the Nike swoosh, right? Think of Just Do It with the Nike swoosh, their logo and their corporate identification, right? That is something that's trademarked. It belongs to Nike. The concept of the UPS brown color, right? You often hear about people say UPS brown, right? That's trademarked. That's something that's unique to them, to that particular entity. When you think about American Express's catchphrase from a few years ago, right? Where do you want to go today, right? That's a trademarkable slogan or capture or something like that. All those things. Corporate logos, without exception today, are all trademarked. Many of them may be copyrighted as well. Talk about copyrights in a second. But the idea is that ultimately, this is how we provide protection to something that people use every day and see every day, right? You ever play that, we have an app for everything today, yes. Right? You ever play that logo game that's on, they have an app for, you can get the corporate logos, yeah. And they come up, you got to identify what they are. Yep. Yeah, I suck at that. I'm like the horrible, horrible player for that. But I always sit and I do that, especially if I'm traveling, I'm on the plane, I got nothing to do. So I'm playing that all the time on my tablet. And that's a great example of applying this thought process because all the logos that come up are trademarked and or copyrighted, right? All of them probably are trademarked. A lot of them may be copyrighted as well, depending on what they are. Mm-hmm. Copyright is a form of protection that may also provide protection for original works of authorship, right? So the idea is that if I write a book, hypothetically, like the CISSP CBK, the Guide to Knowledge, right, that's out there, the current one that's out there for the 8 domains for the CISSP, if you go and get that book, you will see it is copyrighted, right? ISC Squared owns the copyright to that book because the intellectual property is their intellectual property. So it's a unique work that has never existed before in that way. Now, up until, let's say, maybe 15, 20 years ago, software was kind of out in the cold because we didn't really extend the protection of a copyright to software. It was digital. It was in the digital domain. It was a digital work. But it was not clear, based on copyright law, that software could indeed be afforded at the protection of copyrights. It is now and has been for a fair amount of time, but copyrights can be extended to software, and indeed they are. And so things like the Windows operating system, VMware's ESXi operating system, the favorite operating system of Mike on his laptop, right, the Macintosh operating system, all of those are copyrighted as well. If you go to use those and you use them without paying a fee, we call that a licensing fee, you're effectively violating the usage terms of the copyright. And the owner, Apple, Microsoft, VMware, whoever, has the right, in theory, to come sue you and get their money back and whatever damages they may say they incurred along the way. Right? So copyrights are very important as well. Want to make sure we know the difference between a patent, a trademark, and a copyright. They are very important. We want to have a good working definition of them as we think about the different ways in which we can apply intellectual property controls. When we also think about intellectual property, we're not just thinking about, hey, it's out there, we've got these things called trademarks, patents, copyrights. What about laws that, beyond the realm of just that protection, actually govern the use and consumption and trade and selling of goods and services? We have those as well. So those things I just mentioned, trademarks, patents, and copyrights, do all those things. But we also have legal agreements that countries sign or buy into that also fall into this category. We have something known as ITAR. ITAR is an acronym that stands for International Traffic in Arms Regulations. The ITAR arrangements are a group of agreements that countries can effectively sign on for that govern the use of what we would call dual-use goods. And you may be thinking, why are we talking about arms regulation in an information security course, right? We're not selling arms. No, we're not, but underneath ITAR, underneath EAR, which is the Export Administration Regulations in the United States as well, and underneath something known as the Wassenaar Arrangement, and Wassenaar is also going to be one of these international agreements. All three of these classify technology, specifically computer technology, as dual-use goods. And so they are going to be constrained and governed underneath these agreements because we can use computers and encryption algorithms in particular to create not only secure environments, but potentially to hide activities that may be nefarious, right? People get up to no good, and they can use computers to build weapon systems, and they can use computers to create weapons of mass destruction, and all sorts of stuff that obviously is regulated by other, right, more overarching legal requirements and legal agreements. So we have these agreements, and we classify technology from a computer space in them because they are, or it is considered to be dual use. And as a result, we have to just be aware of that as well. Wassenaar is really probably the biggest one, one that you'd want to be aware of. Wassenaar.org, if you're interested, is where you can find more information about it. The Wassenaar arrangement's been around for some time. It is fairly popular, and it is one that you should at least just in passing know and know about, right? That's going to be important. Generically, when we think about privacy, as we've been talking about the management of information, the governance of it, the association of copyrights, trademarks, and patents, we want to think about privacy from a slightly different perspective. The guidelines that help us to define policy are very important. The OECD guidelines specifically, which are going to be the guidelines that the Organization of Economic or for Economic Cooperation and Development has put out. They're called the OECD 8 core principles, are also very important when we think about it when it comes to privacy. We think about the idea of collection limitation. We think about data quality. We think about purpose specification. We think about use limitation. We think about security safeguards, that's 5. Openness, individual participation, and data control or accountability. These are the 8 core principles. You can find them at the OECD website. OECD.org is where you would find these. And these all speak to and help us to govern and really think through the focusing on the ideas about how we capture information, how we manage it, and ultimately what we do with it. So for instance, when you think about purpose specification and use limitation, we're thinking about what we're capturing data for and narrowly defining that need so that we don't capture more data than we need, and as a result, expose data from a confidentiality perspective when it's not supposed to be. It's one example of how the core guidelines or the core guiding principles are applied when we think about the principles of privacy and what they stand for. And finally, as we wrap up our conversations in this area, just some quick definitions, right? Data breach terminology. It's always fun to say. Terminology, it's a fun word, right? What we're thinking about is just vocabulary. And so we want to think about the difference between incident, the difference between breach. These two are very similar in definition, almost identical in fact, and we want to just differentiate between the focus. Incident is an event of some kind, whatever it is, obviously security focused in this case, right, that has the potential to do harm to one or more of the elements of confidentiality, integrity, and/or availability. So an incident is something that's happened, and it has the potential to negatively impact confidentiality, integrity, and/or availability. Whereas a breach is an incident that has not only happened, but now we've classified as clearly impacting one or more of those three elements, and as a result of that, has somehow disclosed or modified or rendered data unavailable. And as a result of that, the data, the target of the breach, has been compromised, is what we would say. And so incident and breach are two very important terms as we think about not only information security, but specifically privacy, governance, risk, and compliance-based activities.
That's a lot of great information there, Adam. Help, you know, we got to see about compliance and how we have different areas that we're going to have to be compliant in, and understanding in a global context. Even companies that might not think they're global, we see that data might be traveling across those geographical boundaries, and as a CISSP, we've got to be aware of that. We've got to understand what that means and how that impacts the decisions we're making when it comes to protecting that data. Thanks again, Adam, for all that information. Remember, if you want to attend one of Adam's live classes, shoot an email over to catpro.tv. That's going to do it for this episode. Signing off, I'm Mike Roderick.
I'm Adam Gordon. See you soon.
We'll see you next time.